CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back to Unbranded, the show where we explore the extraordinary link between human and brand behavior. I'm Timothy Maurice, and I get great joy in unpacking how brands impact the psyche of people and how people can inspire and build brands. At the end of the show, we will have a special episode, as we always do, with Rianette Lebowitz, a cyber health feature today. But today we live in an era where brands and brand narratives shape our world on a conscious and subconscious level like never before. Few brands are under more scrutiny than Brand America and Brand South Africa. In fact, the entire world is undergoing a shift. But from a cultural perspective, these two countries represent a metaphor about how the East and West are being turned upside down in pursuit of a new ideology. This shift has major implications on leadership, as well as how leaders run their organizations. To explore the power of cultures and narratives to impact corporate and nation identities, we are joined today by leadership and cultural disruptor, Mr. Vivek Wadera. Vivek, welcome to Unbranded.
Thank you much, Tim.
You are in India right now, New Delhi, in fact.
That's right. That's correct.
Awesome. How is the buzz there?
Awesome. This is a real melting pot of cultures. I think you can really, on a day-to-day basis, see the manifestation of the West and East mingling in a way that hasn't happened here in a long, long, long time. So, very interesting place.
Let's be clear to our listeners. You are literally in, you live in South Africa at the moment, and you're there sort of for a family work sort of excursion.
That's correct. So I am based in South Africa, but I am of Indian origin, the son of Indian immigrants to Africa who moved there many decades ago. I'm here for I was here for a wedding and okay. To conduct some business.
Got it. Let me ask you this. Are people, I noticed that people around the world, I was in a class recently in the U.S. where there were 15 countries represented, and out of the 15 countries, not a single person was happy with their leadership. Are people happy in New Delhi?
I would endeavor to say presently no.
So you can join us.
Absolutely. There was a general sentiment of increased nationalism a while ago under the rule of the current prime minister of this country, but he recently introduced a demonetization policy that is causing some pain to certain constituencies of the population.
Awesome. So one of the things that I'm intrigued by is how much things are just sort of going flipped upside down right now. We are in a fascinating chapter in history. We need help, Vivek. I mean, please tell us you're going to provide some extraordinary answers to Fees Must Fall challenge, the political challenge, the diversity issues. You know, I don't want to put too much pressure on you, but your title as a sort of a leadership and cultural disruptor, before you tell us you're going to provide any answers, tell us, what is it you're really passionate about?
So what I'm really passionate about is the opportunity that exists in the cultural domain, and the opportunity specifically that exists between two prevalent schools of cultural thought, namely what one could call Western analytical thinking, which I also call 21st century thinking, and a more Eastern or Southern approach which I called holistic thinking, which is a more intuitive approach to thinking about the world. And I think there's a lot of discrepancy between those two schools of thought. There's a lot of discrepancy between those two cultures. There are increasingly issues of lack of trust between those schools of thought. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of opportunity in that space, and there are some potential tools and models that we could use to kind of navigate this pretty uncharted territory at this point in our history as a human race.
What do you do for fun? Because that sounds so serious. I'm like, does this guy... Do you go bowling? Do you do...
Well, I don't know how much fun running is, but I do run quite a bit. And I also, believe it or not, I used to break dance.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Like
mainly popping and locking.
And spinning? Did you spin?
I tried, but I haven't done it. I used to a little bit, but I haven't done it in like the last eight years. But here and there, I'll bust out a move. But I'm still able to perform a traditional dance form of northwestern India, which is called Bhangra, which has received quite a bit of exposure in the West. Via the Indian communities or the diaspora in the West. So there's a lot of fusion music that centers around that dance form. So
I have to Google.
I used to dance that. Well, I dance that presently. It's Bhangra.
Bhangra.
Ngra.
Ngra. I'm gonna Google that, and I can imagine if you were to fuse that with some hip hop popping.
It's already happening.
I can already see it becoming viral. Vivek, in many ways, you are a symbol of the new emerging global order. You are inherently global. Take us through the first 20 years of your life. Just give us a couple snapshots. I mean, you've got an American identity. You've got,
sure,
African, Indian. Take us just through quickly.
Sure. So I'm the son of Indian immigrants who moved to Africa several decades ago. And I was born in Zambia and raised in Botswana, which is just next door to South Africa. And after high school in Botswana, I went for my tertiary training in the States, and I lived there for 14 years. So I studied there, I lived there, I worked there. I was trained as an engineer and as a professional businessman. And I then moved back to Africa several years ago, and I ran a couple of tech startup companies, most recently I served in a large corporation. I served as a COO in South Africa of Choppies Supermarkets, which is a JSE-listed chain of FMCG retail supermarkets and the fastest growing of its sort in Africa, outside of South Africa. So that's what I've done kind of in terms of my professional CV, if you will, but
sure,
it's been underpinned and underlying all of that has been this constant struggle and constant delight with dealing with the complexities of exchanges between different cultures across all these different countries.
Got it.
And pulling out some patterns out of that, and hopefully patterns that we can use and capitalize on in day-to-day life.
Absolutely. You did your MBA at Kellogg Business School, one of the top business schools.
That's right.
How did your MBA with Kellogg help shape your thinking around particularly leadership and cultures?
So at Kellogg, I was there in 2007, starting in 2007 and graduating in 2009. And emerging markets was kind of the flavor of the day. And there was a lot of effort on the research side at the school, as well as the teaching side, to equip us as much as possible with tools to kind of manage this complexity. Every American company was... every American company of any substance was trying to diversify and globalize into the likes of India, China, and Africa. I was uniquely qualified at the intersection of those cultures, and to that end, I worked on, for example, Harley Davidson's expansion into India. And then, of course, the influx of Western business into Africa also. And that became my career later on. So I would say that it was pretty influential in my career trajectory. And the school was certainly very concerned about what's going on in terms of doing business between cultures.
Awesome. Now, Vivek, you know, that level of experience has given you, in your own sort of professional and personal travels, you know, having that sort of MBA and that kind of network has given you a unique sort of grasp, which is why I wanted to have you on Unbranded. So thank you so much, by the way. And, you know, as a thinker and a consultant in the leadership sort of space, are you hopeful? Are you excited about the potential of where we're going? I mean, a lot of people are sort of, you know, sort of down and out. I mean, they feel like the world is about to end. And, you know, what people don't realize is that the world has gone through, you know, extreme leadership challenges in the past. What about you? Are you hopeful?
I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful of the medium term and long term direction. And potentially even of the short-term direction. Remember that where there's adversity or where people are down and out, there's also opportunity for certain people to see certain patterns and really capitalize on them. And I think that those who know how to navigate this increasing overlap between cultures, East and West or West and South, are those who will actually be quite happy in the imminent future. So I can certainly see some people being extremely happy about the world and the world they live in the imminent future, and some people being upset. But we can also do something for those guys who are upset by providing them with some stories, some hope, and some tools.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Timothy Maurice, and this is Unbranded. I'm chatting to Vivek Wadera, who's in New Delhi, India. He is a leadership and cultural disruptor. Why do you want to disrupt cultures?
I don't think we have a choice other than disrupting cultures. I think that we have conflicting motives within different cultural camps, if you will. And I think the probably one of the best ways to kind of create a unified voice within a given camp is by producing some pretty disruptive ideas, so that people can realize that we're, you know, within any given camp, we're more on a kind of spectrum than we are in divided compartments. So, if you look, for example, at what's been happening in the Western world recently, with the likes of the Brexit or with the likes of Mr. Trump's victory in the United States. What you realize is that the coalitions that won these victories are actually quite divided within themselves in terms of their philosophies. You have, for example, the likes of cultural or social conservatives who are combining forces with economic liberals or free market conservatives or capitalists. And I think they need to find common ground amongst themselves. And I think some disruptive techniques could help with that. And the same would apply to people in the East. So I think within camps we need to unify, and disruption is one way to do that. And then between camps we also need to unify, and disruption is another way to do that.
You know, what's interesting for me is, you know, this sort of philosophy applies to personal and as well as corporate, as well as sort of political leadership, you know, and even in our homes, this philosophy applies. But I want to see how good you really are at this. You know, relationships that are, you know, multicultural, intercultural, like the one I'm in, help, please. So if you are in a relationship and you're dating someone who's from a different culture, and there are sort of cultural clashes, do you have any advice whatsoever? Like, if I'm at a family function and her and my partner's entire family is speaking a language that I don't understand, what should I do? Should I A, walk out? Should I B, raise my hand and say, guys, I'm here, can you please translate for me? Or C, just sit there and stare at everybody? What should I do?
I don't think you should do A. I certainly don't think you should do C either. And I think engagement, or B, is quite important. When you say language, I'll, in this case, use a broader term than just, let's say, spoken language. I'll use I'll use language as a term that refers to several cultural cues, not just spoken language, but for example, body language and nonverbal cues involved in the other culture. I think what's important, Tim, is that when you put before putting yourself in a situation like this, you need to kind of think about in the larger situation, what is this culture that you are embedded in, or the dominant culture that you're embedded in, like in terms of the political environment, and assuming you understand that, and assuming you understand how certain social institutions that are established worked, then you kind of need to figure out how that dominant culture views you, or where you stand in the dominant culture in terms of your socioeconomic status. I think increasingly in this world where globalization has been a mantra, for the last 30, 40 years at least, socioeconomics is pretty important in the context of a socio-political order that you're about to enter. And once you understand your socioeconomic status within that particular order, then I think you need to start thinking about your culture versus theirs. I think it's quite important to understand that because cultures are becoming increasingly more socioeconomic status oriented. Once you understand your socioeconomic status versus your culture and theirs in that context, then you can start figuring out where you stand, where you need to go, and the costs that you will need to overcome to transcend from where you presently are at to the goal you want to achieve. It could be something as simple as having a certain accent, right?
Yes.
That would kind of allow you mobility or allow you entry into the promised land that you want to go within that dominant culture that you've been embedded. But in order to figure out that you need that accent, you need to know what you presently have and then what you'll need to get in.
I've been able to observe in some of your work that you believe that sort of if you are an out-group member or outside of a dominant group, there are sort of cool challenges, or there are challenges that you face sort of socially that not many people think about. Tell us a bit about this sort of cool effect that you've sort of come up with.
Yeah, so the cool effect is what I was calling earlier socioeconomic status. I think that increasingly in this world, coolness is associated with, or can almost synonymously be used with, socioeconomic status, where the economic component is essentially a component of where you kind of stand in the economic pecking order of things. The world is becoming increasingly more capitalist, whether we'd like to believe it or not. That's the general direction I believe it's headed in the long term. And where you stand in terms of your economic status is very important and contributes to coolness. But there's other things that also contribute to coolness. One thing that could contribute to coolness is the background that you come from, right? Culturally. So you may be a well-groomed, highly educated, upper-middle-class gentleman working a nice corporate job in New Delhi, and as such you would be considered to be economically strong. But you may be denied entrance into a premium nightclub as a single man as such if you don't have a female partner with you. Okay. Whereas if you come in potentially as a foreigner from a Western European country, regardless necessarily of your actual economic worth, you may as a single man be allowed in. In these two scenarios of the Indian gentleman versus the gentleman from Western Europe, the coolness perception is different of the bouncer allowing them into the club. And what happens here is that basically the single male is, Indian male, is perceived to be slightly less cool than the single gentleman from Western Europe. And as such, he's denied entry into the nightclub. And therefore, he has a cost that he has to overcome, right? The cost he has to overcome is he has to find himself a female partner in order to essentially pay his way into the club. So I think within a given domain or a given scenario, coolness as a function of culture is very real. It differs drastically depending on which culture you are perceived to be coming from. And those of us who want to be more mobile and get ahead in life need to figure out our relative coolness and figure out the cost that we need to spend to kind of overcome those barriers and enter that promised land, in this case, the nightclub.
So let me be clear. So
yeah.
I'm at this family function. If this, mm-hmm. if this family is speaking their language and they're not interpreting to me and they keep me on the outside, maybe I'm just not cool to them. Maybe they don't want me involved. Maybe I need to reassess my entire relationship because I have a feeling after this conversation that I'm just not that cool. And maybe they're plotting a breakup. Maybe they're plotting how to get rid of me. Anyway, mm-hmm. thank you for helping with that. I need to understand the cost, and I need to figure out how I need to strategically assess the situation and figure out where I lay, where I sit, my status in this dynamic, and understand the dominant culture a little bit better. I love the framing of this. This is very powerful. You know, in a moment, we're going to play a song. But before we play this song, I want to know, and I want you to brace yourself for this question. Are you ready?
Go ahead.
You know, out of the sort of 20 years you spent between sort of India, Botswana, America, and, you know, your other sort of travels, you know, I hear from scientists that we're about 99.9% the same from a DNA perspective.
Yes.
What do you think we exaggerate our differences?
I don't think we exaggerate our differences. I think what happens is that we have this fantastic ability as humans to take unrelated information and unrelated opportunities and attach them to a problem or opportunity at hand and then capitalize on it for whatever our means or ends are. Okay. So let me give you an example. If you look at what happened in terms of the Brexit, many folks say that it was an economic matter at the kernel of the problem. I would actually endeavor to say that no, it was a cultural backlash at the kernel of the problem, but we had this ability to kind of surround it with all kinds of economic and other rhetoric to make it bigger than, well, to give it another dimension. Having said that, if you just drill down to the very kernel of the problem and assume that the cultural backlash was the central issue, that issue is actually very, very big, in my opinion. And I think it's a big area of dialogue as to how do you bridge the gap between a very structured, sometimes somewhat dogmatic scientific method, powered way of thought, versus, which is prevalent in the West, versus a perhaps more flexible, more intuitive, less rule-bound, but potentially equally effective cultural paradigm of holistic thinking from the East. I think that's quite a big gap to traverse, and so I think the problem is potentially not exaggerated in that sense.
So we're about to play a song now. Tell us why you love the song so much.
So this song, which is called Meditation, is by a close friend called Pratish Mistry, who's a musician based in South Africa. And the song derives or is inspired by a book of his called The Universe and the Mad Butterfly, which essentially gives expression to the idea of how we live in a universe that is interrelated in ways that we may not realize. And I think that's a hallmark of kind of holistic thinking. And if we endeavor to kind of understand that, then I think those of us who are conditioned in a very Western analytical 21st century way of thinking can kind of be more at ease in cultural interactions with the other side, if you will.
This is Timothy Maurice. If you listen back on the podcast, do your research. Go check out Pratish Mystery. That's Pratishmistry. And the song was called Meditation. Check it out. We're back with Vivek Wadera, who is a leadership and cultural disruptor who works with leaders, works with organizations to understand the sort of explosive power of considering values and dynamics outside of the borders of your own comfort zone and your own culture. And Vivek, we really appreciate you joining us all the way from New Delhi. How many people are in New Delhi now?
Hey, the last official number I saw was 14 million, but I'm sure it's much more than that.
Are you serious? 14 yep. million people. I think New York has like 8 million. I mean, that just gives some perspective. Johannesburg yep. in South Africa. I think Botswana, the largest city in Botswana is which one?
It's Gaborone.
Which has probably, what, 400,000?
Yep.
Incredible. So you had 14 million Indeed. People. It's an exciting time in history. We're talking today about the power and potential to explore outside of your own sort of boundaries and how cultures come together. Also considering your own place within the context. And we were just speaking about the sort of coolness factor. And I've experienced this a lot. I experience it as a speaker. Oftentimes, I've been invited to speak to, you know, extreme academics. So I don't have a PhD. Mm-hmm. I just simply have sort of the equivalent of an undergraduate degree. I don't have a master's, mm-hmm. but I've spoken at times at some of the top business schools to PhD. So if you look at the economic status, or not just the economic, mm-hmm. but it's a social status, you know, you could pitch me at a much lower level. So as a speaker, I come in and my sort of coolness sort of factor or quotient would be much less than the person or the group that I'm speaking to. So as an out-group member, I've had to sort of retool myself and sort of reposition myself and find out what it is they care about in their culture, in their dynamic, in their in-group. And when you do it, I find people really, really open. And people open and mm-hmm. accept you in their in-group. But there is a point where you have to physically make the effort. You can't stand on the outside and look inside and go, these people are like this, these people are like that. Would you say that mm-hmm. the onus is on the out-group member, particularly if they need the in-group? I mean, or should you sort of expect people to sort of just want to welcome you?
I think the onus is on the out-group member. I guess the very fact that an out-group member may have to or have to struggle with it is probably indicative of the fact that there isn't a broader social conscience for in-group members to make accommodations for the out-group members. So if you're already, then that probably means that the onus is on you as an out-group member. I think the good news is twofold. One piece of good news is that there are tools out there. There are identity and cultural leadership models that would allow you to figure out where you stand, where you want to go, and what the specific costs are. What you spoke about a moment ago about doing a certain thing that kind of unlocks the group. There are ways to quickly identify that and realize patterns about patterns relating to how to quickly do that.
Let's say
the other piece of.
Sorry, I just want to say this. I want the listener to be clear. At the end of it, in mm-hmm. just a few moments, we're going to give you the opportunity to give us some tips and some strategy. Okay.
Yeah.
So some yeah. thinking specifically for leaders and those who are dealing with this dynamic. I mean, especially in South Africa. If you're listening from South Africa, I want you to zoom in on this conversation because there is a. I have experienced it myself. There's extraordinary opportunity to be able to experience the abundance of all cultures if you have sort of a mindset that engineers entry. And so Vivek is going to share with us some of those thoughts. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No worries. Look, there are tools out there that would allow you to quickly identify what needs to be done in order to enter the in-group. And if you overcome that cost, then yes, you will be allowed entry and probably potentially even with a very nice welcome. The second piece of good news is that if there is a broader social conscience, and this is most conducive probably for corporates, leaders of organizations can use such tools to figure out not only their perspective as gatekeepers into promised lands, for out-group members, but also use those to figure out the mentality or the challenges of the aspiring out-group member who wants to get into, who wants to cross the gate into the gatekeeper's domain. So it could allow perspective taking for both the gatekeeper in the promised land as well as the prospective out-group member. And I think that's potentially quite useful in a place like South Africa, where along cultural lines, along ethnic lines, you have a lot of gatekeepers. It would be useful for them to understand what's going on in the mind of a potential aspirant into their particular promised land, as well as frame their own mindset and identify specifically the costs that they potentially subconsciously have as a prerequisite for the outgroup member to come in.
I would say what's interesting about the way you frame this is you make it really simple, and I appreciate that. You know, historically, you couldn't pay. One of the most interesting things about where we are in society is that if you're willing to pay those costs, to invest in understanding the cost, it can really pay off in a major way. But historically, if you were a slave, no matter what cost you're willing to pay, you remained a slave. You were an out-group member. If you were in some sort of colonial dynamic, you weren't able to pay the cost inside of a university because you weren't allowed to go. And I think I get excited about it, and I think people take for granted some of these costs are frustrating, and the structural dynamics that are in place and the systematic, the historical dynamics that have created systems that favor certain groups, yes, they're frustrating, but more importantly, it's an exciting time in history because I feel like every cost I've ever paid to get in on an in-group where I saw value, I have received many more returns. And sort of the multiplier effect of that has just been so rewarding and so rich for me. Just quickly, you've developed a model. You've developed a model that's quite unique, and it's part of the reason why your unique sort of value resonates and it's starting to grow, and sort of and the leaders are starting to contact you. Tell us a bit more about the model.
So it's a very simple model. Perhaps in business school tradition, it's a 2x2 matrix. Okay, and I'll try to verbally describe it so that you and your listeners can maybe just visualize it in your head. Imagine a 2x2 matrix where on one axis you have what's called culture, and there's two possible values for culture. One is what I would call a dominant culture, and the other would be maybe what you could call a subordinate or a native culture. And on the other axis is what I call socioeconomic status or coolness, and that has two values, which is low and high.
Got it.
So that's kind of the lay of the land, if you will, and so you have four quadrants. Now, what usually happens, and this is also very applicable to South Africa, is that there's a lot of folks who find themselves in the quadrant which is at the intersection of what you would consider maybe a native or non-dominant culture and low socioeconomic status.
Okay.
And they want to traverse into a quadrant which tends to be occupied by people of a dominant culture and of high socioeconomic status. So the question is, how do you walk across these quadrants kind of from the bottom left of the square to the top right of the square? And usually it involves two steps, sometimes one step. But it's important for you as the aspirant to figure out where you stand in which quadrant, and then identify for traversing from one quadrant into another, potentially into your destination quadrant, which I sometimes call the promised land, if you will. But what's very important here, Tim, is that it requires you not only for you to identify your own cost, but to identify and kind of put yourself in the shoes of the gatekeeper in the destination quadrant.
Okay.
And how they think and what costs may be important to them. So you kind of need to take two perspectives in order to really figure out how this thing works. And the idea is that once you identify the costs that are important to them and the costs that are important to you, well, then you make up to traverse the costs, as unfortunate as they may be, and they are realities that exist. And the idea to do what's necessary in terms of a personal plan for a year, for example, to make that happen. If you are really enterprising and you engage the gatekeeper, I think it can in a very fruitful relationship. This model for which is a cultural identity and leadership model. How it works is, I think it's important or useful to imagine kind of how it looks. It's basically a 2x2 matrix. The 2x2 matrix has on one axis what I call culture, and there are two values to that axis. One is what I call a dominant culture, and the other one is what I call a non-dominant culture. On the x-axis, or the other axis, is what I call coolness or socioeconomic status.
Yes, got it.
And so you have this 2x2 matrix, and the socioeconomic status axis has two values, low and high. So a lot of people in a lot of emerging market contexts, and certainly in South Africa, lie in the quadrant, the one of four quadrants that is at the intersection of low socioeconomic status and non-dominant culture. And I think a lot of people want a rite of passage. They want to figure out a way to get into a quadrant which lies at the intersection of high socioeconomic status and dominant culture. And so what this model allows you to do is it allows you to firstly identify where you presently are and where you want to go. And it allows you to identify perspectives, namely your perspective as in what you need to do, what costs you need to pay to traverse between different quadrants, and the perspective of the gatekeeper in the final quadrant where you want to end up. And the cost that that gatekeeper would likely expect from you, consciously or subconsciously.
Okay.
So I think as an aspirant, what this model allows you to do is identify all those variables. And it may be very useful also to discuss this model with your gatekeeper, because I think it can open some fantastic channels for dialogue wherein the gatekeeper may actually bring to his or her conscious, subconscious things or costs that they never potentially realize they actually do. And I think it brings the conversation out in a much more objective way, because the conversation is happening on that matrix in that model. So it involves two people and the model, not just two people. So I think it removes some subjectivity out of that whole equilibrium.
That's one of the things I enjoy and I appreciate about it. And I think that we need a lot more people engaged in this in strategic workshops. You mm-hmm. will facilitate workshops with teams, and will you work with leaders? You know, what is the scope of your work?
So the scope of the work is quite broad and also can be quite focused. Broad in the sense that this applies to anyone who is looking to traverse a cultural domain or cultural landscape and wants to basically become more mobile and gain entry into certain quadrants of that cultural domain, if you will. But it can be specifically tailored for audiences ranging from university students to senior management, to C-suite executive management in corporations, since I have experience spanning, you know, all those different strata.
Got it. And where are you most excited to in sort of invest this sort of conversation? Is it at the extremes with leaders as well as with sort of young people to understand when they graduate, this is how they're going to have to deal with this sort of cultural dynamics?
I think it has to be done at both ends of the spectrum, if you will. I don't think it can effectively be done by focusing on just one or the other. If you recall, one of the words I used was perspective. Two perspectives are enforced in this model. One is the perspective of the aspirant, and the other perspective is that of the gatekeeper.
Yes.
And so I think a lot of students are aspirants, and they need to figure out, fortunately or unfortunately, what cost they need to pay in a country like South Africa to move forward. And I think that the gatekeepers who tend to be leaders also need to figure out that there is an aspirant out there, that aspirant does have costs that I'm consciously or subconsciously charging the aspirant to enter into the inner circle, if you will. So I think the process needs to happen at both ends of the spectrum.
I like that. Was it charging? I'm just thinking about how much I've been charged my whole life. Where were you charged? Where were you charged the most? When you came to Botswana, Africa, or was it when you were in America?
So, Tim, I was not actually charged that much in the U.S. Because there was a, I feel there was an institutional landscape that removed the need for a lot of costs. And I think that's one reason that potentially America, at least certainly, used to appear to be such an immigrant-friendly place or an aspirant-friendly place. I did find costs, though, in South Africa, whether the cost was in terms of how I was groomed, in terms of how I dressed, for example, or the accent that I had, or the nationality that I stated that I carry. I found that it made a difference when I would appear to be a man of Indian origin versus when I would appear to be a guy who looks Indian but actually has a U.S. passport. So, and oddly enough, I also found substantial costs in India, and the nightclub example I gave earlier is an example of that.
Okay.
Wherein the cost was female companionship as a single man trying to enter an upscale club.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know,
indeed.
When you know, looking forward as sort of a visionary in this space, what are some of the one or two things quickly as we sort of wrap up that you think people must know or they must incorporate if they really want to thrive in a multicultural landscape?
So, I think what's important to understand is, firstly, that that there are serious issues of trust between cultures that are increasing worldwide and in South Africa. So between Western 21st century schools of thought and more holistic schools of thought, the trust deficit, I think, is on the rise, as evidenced by what happened in the UK with the Brexit, by the Trump victory, as well as in South Africa, where the percentage that is the percentage of people who easily trust is actually lower than the world average, at least according to the likes of things like the World Value Survey. So there is a trust deficit between cultures that needs to be traversed. And this is over and beyond just the regular cost that I mentioned.
Okay.
The second thing I wanted to mention was that something can be done about these this increasing cost deficit as well as the cost that we've spoken about. And that basically involves figuring out where you are in a particular scenario and where you need to go. And if you figure those things out, then you need to create a plan around it. For example, if you map out now where you are in a specific cultural scenario and where you want to be next year, then you probably need to start planning it right now and make a plan for it in 2017. And finally, if you can, I would advise actually going to the gatekeeper with your thoughts and with your mapping and actually have a three-way conversation that involves you, the gatekeeper, and a model such as the model we just discussed. And I think that could produce some unexpected, potentially pleasant results.
We were joined today by the extraordinary sort of visionary thinker, Mr. Vivek Wadera, who is a leadership and cultural disruptor. Vivek, for people, do you have sort of a universal Gmail address that anyone anywhere in the world who is listening, who downloaded this podcast on cliffcentral.com or iTunes can get in touch with you?
Sure thing. My email address is my first name followed by my last name at gmail.com. So that's Vivek Wadera at gmail.com, okay. Spelled VivekWadhera. At gmail.com.
Awesome. We are very grateful that you took the time and joined us to share your insights. We're looking forward to, you know, many more sort of publishings and conversations with you. Do you have a book or you have any sort of thought leadership work that you're working on at the moment?
I do. There is work that will manifest on my blog imminently, as well as some major publications in South Africa, and eventually a book at some point next year.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And for those of you who have subscribed to Unbranded, we're really grateful as always, and we look forward to you joining us. And please, you can email me, Timothy@TimothyMaurice.com or TimothyMaurice@gmail.com, or follow me on Twitter, Timothy Maurice. And if you're on Instagram and you like photos, just Insta Timothy. We'll be back next week with another episode of Unbranded. CliffCentral.com.